Hey everyone, Dr. Jason Old here, surfer, historian, world traveler, and your host of the Surfing Historian Podcast. This season, we'll be diving deeper into the nuanced world of surfing and examining the historical, cultural, philosophical, and even scientific elements of the sport we're all stoked on. So let's paddle out together and ride through the world of academia. This episode is sponsored by Sovereign Republic. Check out their amazing backpacks at sovereignrepublic.com. I've been personally using their ambassador backpack for all my travels for the last 5 or so years, and it's still as good as new. It's lightweight, stylish, durable, and designed to be carry-on approved for most global airlines. Be sure to use promo code STAYSTOKED for a 15% discount site-wide on their awesome gear. Joining me today is Dr. Chad Nelson. Chad's the CEO of the Surfrider Foundation, the world's largest grassroots coastal and ocean conservation organization dedicated to the protection and enjoyment of the world's oceans, waves, and beaches. Chad has over 25 years of experience in ocean and coastal conservation, working at the intersection of advocacy, ocean recreation, and grassroots organizing. With a doctorate in environmental science and engineering from UCLA, he also has a strong foundation in science, policy, and management. Through his research at UCLA, Chad became a founder in the field of surfonomics, that is, the study of the economic values of surfing and ocean recreation. For today's episode, he and I'll chat about surfonomics, as well as some of the threats our oceans and coasts face, and the important role that surfers and surfing can play in the conservation of our beautiful planet. I'm super stoked to have you on the show. Chad and I are constantly crossing paths at conferences around the world, so it's nice to pin him down to learn a bit more about what he's up to. But before we get started, I want to personally thank you, Chad, as well as our listeners, for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
Hey, Jason, thanks so much. Stoked to see you since the Global Wave Conference in Portugal, and look forward to chatting.
Yeah, Chad, of course, you know, always a pleasure for me too. I just kind of want to ease in before I get into some more specific questions about your doctoral research, your work, of course, with the Surfrider Foundation. But, I guess before we get into the doctoral stuff, I do want to talk about the Surfrider Foundation. But would you mind just for the listeners who are unfamiliar with either Surfrider or your role with them, would you just mind sharing with all of us kind of what you do and how you got into it, actually?
Sure, absolutely. So the Surfrider Foundation is a grassroots coastal and ocean conservation organization. We've got 200 chapters and clubs across the U.S. and 7 international affiliates. We focus on issues like clean water, plastic pollution in the ocean, coastal development and climate change, ocean health, and beach access. Those are really the issues that we work on. Surfrider was founded in 1984, so next year is our 40th anniversary. So we've been around a long time, and I've also been at Surfrider for a long time. This is my 25th year. And even before that, I was a grad student intern at Surfrider in 1995. And that's how I got introduced to Surfrider. I was a broke grad student getting my master's and came home for the summer in Laguna Beach, where I grew up, and lived with my folks, worked with my dad, who ran a ocean science summer camp to make some money, and started volunteering at the Surfrider Foundation to get some experience, and just fell in love with the place. And 3 years later, got a job sort of running some of the programs, water quality monitoring, a beach mapping project, and worked my way up and took over about a little over 9 years ago as the CEO.
Yeah, it's a fascinating organization. And, you know, I, of course, Surfrider is on the surfinghistorian.com under NGOs. You know, I even in my history of surfing class, I'm, you know, always trying to encourage students to plug into you guys. And so, yeah, that's well, I actually personally didn't know it had been around since the 1980s. So that's incredible. Before we dig into your academic research, what would you say some of the differences are between the efforts of the Surf Rider Foundation in the 80s and maybe now? Just something brief, because we will dig deeper into this for sure.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. In the 1980s, when Surf Rider was founded, it was kind of founded for two reasons. One was it was founded in Malibu, and surfers were getting sick at Malibu. There was a wastewater treatment plant up the creek, Tapia, that was dumping untreated waste into the creek that was coming out of, you know, one of the most iconic surf spots in the world. So the surfers were tired of getting sick. And surfers were still kind of marginalized back then. It was kind of like the Spicoli stereotype, uneducated, dropout, selfish, not really contributing to society. And interesting, because we've come full circle, is in 1984, the Olympics were in Los Angeles. And the founders of Surf Rider were three guys: Lance Carson, a pro surfer, Tom Pratt, an environmentalist, and a guy named Glenn, who worked at JPL. And they were looking at the Olympics and were like, wow, you know, these athletes are a symbol of like hope and success and, you know, peace and just this really big thing. And surfers were included in that. So they kind of wanted to both change the public perception of surfers and also tackle some important ocean issues that are making surfers sick.
Oh, that's awesome. So yeah, so really now that, you know, surfing, let's say, is taken a bit more seriously, you know, is something we're going to talk about today as well, is surfing in the Olympics. So now it's more surf riders evolved into specifically conservation, much less bringing credibility to surfers in and of themselves. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, thanks. And I kind of forgot the second part of your question. But yeah, so Surf Rider, you know, focused on local issues in Southern California. Surfers focused on that image thing and also protecting local surf spots. They had a Baja assistance program. So they kind of had a little bit of humanitarian work. Over time, one of the ways the organizations evolved is the way I like to think about it. It started with surfers protecting surf spots, pretty myopic. Trying to help other surfers in around the world. The organization Surfers Around the Globe said, wow, look at these surfers taking action. They wanted to do more. The organization was tiny. So that's where the grassroots thing started. They said, hey, we can't help you, but we can help you start something like us where you are. That's how our chapter model began. And then it became, you know, hey, surfers protecting communities. You know, then it became surfers protecting the ocean, right? These big issues like offshore drilling, plastic pollution, climate change are sort of ocean-wide. You know, and I would argue now we're looking at sort of like surfing and ocean conservation's role in planetary conservation, you know, with these global issues. So, you know, surfers are a great sort of symbol, I think, for ocean protection. And, you know, if not surfers who invested so much and get so much from the ocean, who's going to care more?
Yeah. And, you know, as you're talking, a couple of things come to mind, you know, particularly with the, you know, sort of ocean, keeping the oceans clean and whatnot. I know you said that, I believe Surf Rider started initially in 1984. There was a 1983 Mad Magazine edition with the Alfred E. Newman. I think you remember that, where Alfred E. Newman's surfing this wave and it's just surrounded with trash. And, you know, something I try to convey to people is that, you know, we're really, you know, adamant about it now, but it was still a pressing issue back when you guys started, you know? And so the other thing that came to mind is, you know, a lot of times we hear people say, you know, you and I being, you know, scholars as well, is that, oh, well, surfers are aloof, you know, they are aloof and selfish and, you know, all these different things. And really the Surf Rider Foundation and all the things that you guys are doing, and a number of others around the world, are really kind of dispelling that myth. So, You know, what are your thoughts on that when you, you know, you hear people say, oh, well, surfers are, you know, they're aloof. They don't care. They just want to go catch waves.
Yeah. You know, there's that. And I also think people think surfers are dumb. And there, you know, I remember when I would tell people I was doing my, you know, I was a, you know, well, A, at Surfrider, this input of surfers was often discounted because they're like, oh, it's the surfers. How smart they can they be? And, you know, that has really changed over time. You know, and then this, like, you know, it's been really fun to watch, you know, this kind of like movement towards academia and surfing is really expanded. And I think the Global Wave Conference, which we'll talk about, has played a role in that. But, you know, I would tell people still today, you know, hey, you're a doctor. What did you do your research in? Surfonomics. And I always get a laugh, you know, because they're like, how could they don't take that very seriously. So, you know, there's still some work to be done there. And, you know, we'll talk about it more when I talk about my research. But, you know, when I did the sort of the just the basic demographics, which was foundational for the work, you know, people were always surprised by what I found because those stereotypes have been so persistent. And, you know, on this sort of aloof and selfish side, I think there's a little element to that. I think if you look at any sport that people are super passionate about, mountaineering, rock climbing, golf, you know, mountain biking, surfing, people who are really, really sort of addicted to those sports are willing to make sacrifices in order to pursue them, which sort of we all do too. But that does not preclude you from, you know, wanting to give back.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, I do want to get into your research now because, you know, and this is something I've talked about with a lot of guests on the podcast, you know, because virtually everyone's a scholar and they focus on surfing. And, you know, it's that eye roll that we all get when, you know, yeah, I'm doing my PhD, which yours was at UCLA, which is an incredible university. You know, and it's like, yeah, on surfonomics, you're like, okay, yeah, guy, whatever. You just want to go surf. Yeah. You know, mine is on Nicaragua. It's on the, you know, sort of the proliferation of surf tourism there. You know, if I, as a historian, were studying the Contra War or the Revolution, it seems much more academic. But as you and I both well know, like, you, our work is heavy in the academic, you know, it's strong academic work. And so, you know, I want to use that as a segue to get into your research. Your dissertation title is, you know, correct me if I get it wrong, but collecting and using economic information to guide the management of coastal recreational resources in California. So, what, you know, I get it. You know, you surf, we surf, we love surfing, but what compelled you to, let's say, pursue a PhD, and why did you sort of guide it towards a focus heavily focused on surfing?
Yeah, those are good questions. So, a couple different things happened to me that drove me to go get my doctoral degree, and I did that also kind of relatively late in life. I kind of went back to school. You know, I had a house, a wife, and two kids. So it was not the typical, you know, I was in my early 30s when I did that. So, but I was working on a project in Puerto Rico. It was a kind of a unique project. It was kind of a surfing coral reef conservation project at a place called Tres Palmas in Rincon, Puerto Rico. Beautiful Elkhorn coral reefs that are threatened. Big wave surf spot, which most people don't know exists in the Caribbean, and was under threat from a number of things: overfishing, condo development that was causing sedimentation. And we were working on a conservation project down there, and we wanted to set up a marine protected area, marine reserve around these coral reefs where the surf spot, Tres Palmas, breaks. And we were like, hey, we can do a, we thought the novel thing then was going to be to do a marine protected area focused on this recreation and conservation things. It's usually solely conservation. And so we were like, hey, this would be cool. We can save these reefs and save the surf and kind of, and, you know, setting up no take zones in marine reserves is challenging business. And so we were trying to work with the local fishing community and coastal tourism and others in the town. And we were getting a lot of pushback. And there was this sense, this was in the early 2000s, that conservation and economic development were at odds. So the more conservation, the less opportunity for economic development. So we were getting opposed by not only the fishing communities, but also coastal tourism, the town. And I was working with some folks at Environmental Defense Fund. They had this great idea. Let's bring in a natural resource economist, have him kind of do a rapid assessment of this town and talk about what's driving the economy. They had the good sense to think that it was coastal tourism and recreation, which it was. So this guy named Linwood Pendleton, he was at USC, then in UCLA, who ultimately became my advisor, came down, did this rapid economic survey, and he found a couple things. One, most people coming to Rincon were going there, not too surprisingly, to surf, go to the beach, snorkel the reefs, dive. And so he's like this, he's like, the environment is the economy. And also, interestingly enough, you know, this is something I'm sure you've looked at. It was mostly small businesses, casitas. It was pre-Airbnb, but, you know, small little local restaurants and rentals and cabinas. And so all that money was getting it going into the local community and staying there because they didn't have mass tourism. So it turned out that, the, you know, protecting these marine resources was really good. He wrote like a little 5-page report. And that report was just the total game changer for our conservation efforts. It really worked. People are like, wow, didn't understand, didn't think it that way. It changed the whole orientation of the conversation. And, you know, we were able to set up the Marine Reserve, and it's become a model for conservation in that town 20 years later. And so I saw that and said, okay, wow, that's interesting. Natural resource economics is a really powerful tool for conservation. Doesn't seem to be used as much as it should or could be. And a couple of years later, this guy, Linwood Pendleton, this pretty well-known natural resource economist, he called me up and said, hey, I'm going to this cool program at UCLA, Environmental Science and Engineering, a multidisciplinary program. It's kind of professional-based. I actually got a doctorate of environmental science. Would you be interested in joining me on the and doing your dissertation research on natural resource economics? And I said, yeah, sounds interesting. Let's do it. And so, you know, I made the questionable choice, ultimately good choice, to, you know, try to keep my job, raise my family, and join them at UCLA. And, you know, I started doing what most early academics do. I started reading the literature to understand what's going on out there. So I was reading about, you know, natural resource economics on, there's a lot of research on beach going, for example, value of a beach day, beach economic impact of beaches, some research on diving in the Caribbean in particular. And as I read the kind of research, I was like, wow, there's zero, absolutely zero on surfing. Sea Grant, which is, you know, a sort of NOAA practical research kind of group, had done a couple of reports on surf contests in at the North Shore of Hawaii on the impact, the economic impact, how much money those contests bring in. That was it. And so I said, oh, wow, well, here I am, interested in this topic, looking for kind of a research angle, and there's like nothing on surfing. And the other piece of information, which we'll get to, I think part of your question is, we were also in this big fight at Surfrider to protect Trestles, a world-class sort of surfing area, from a massive toll road that was going to kind of impact the watershed right in our backyard. So I was like, no one's looked at surfing. We've got one of the most popular surf spots in the world in our backyard, and it's under threat. This is a place to do the research. So that's kind of how I ended up at UCLA looking at surfing and surfonomics.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, you know, and it's, I feel like a lot of us share a similar sort of trajectory in that, we love surfing. We get into these programs and we want to weave surfing into it. And we find, you know, limited resources because it's such a new field. And I know when you, I think you were, yours was 2012 or something.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was what we call, you know, now critical surf studies was pretty, pretty new. And so, and so you were just talking, alluding to it. I just want to kind of pick your brain a bit more on this term surfonomics. I know we had, and I know you know them, Ana Manero and Javier León. I had them on season one and they talked about, sort of the surfing or economic valuation, I believe, of Noosa over in Australia. So I'm sure you're familiar with it, but, so I guess for the listeners who didn't hear that episode, would you mind, since it's my understanding that you really are one of the first people to use that term, and kind of in your own words, what is surfonomics and how do you apply it to somewhere like Trestles or Tres Palmas or some of these places you've been mentioning?
Yeah. So, you know, surfonomics is just kind of a, you know, a clever buzzword, right? You just add anomics to anything. And when you're talking about economics, but you know, what I was focused on was, okay, there's sort of two pieces to it. Surfers are, you know, coastal tourists, and they travel around the world and they visit spots. And when they go to these spots, they spend money. So I live in Laguna Beach. I drive down 20 minutes south to Trestles. I park my car. Maybe I buy gas. Maybe I stop at a surf shop. Maybe I buy breakfast. Probably do some of those things while I'm there. And then I come home. So I kind of left some money in San Clemente because I was visiting Trestles. And that's called economic impact. So, you know, classic tourism thing. This is drives coastal tourism economy all over the world, right? My hometown's a tourist town. Its economy is run by beach visitors coming here and spending money in town. So that's one piece of this that I wanted to look at. And, you know, we'd looked at this for beach going, and I'll get into a little bit of the specifics about this, but no one had looked at surfing. The other piece of it is called non-market value. So, you know, we were talking about skiing before we hopped on here. You know, if you go to a ski resort and you buy a lift ticket, now, you know, $200, and you go skiing for the day, you know, basic economics would suggest that the value of that day of skiing at minimum is worth $200 to you. Otherwise, you wouldn't buy the ticket. And so we know that the value of a day of skiing is $200, you know, for argument's sake. Well, if it's a free resource, hiking the Appalachian Trail, going for, going to a park, going surfing, it's free. So there is no market value to a day of surfing. There's no fee we charge, but it clearly has value to you. If someone said you can't go surfing, you would feel like something got taken away from you. So there's a bunch of different techniques to sort of value that experience. And you can apply those, economic sort of techniques to sort of derive that value. A really classic example of this, it's a little different than what I used. This is called the hedonic valuation, is imagine two identical apartments in New York City on Park Avenue, super desirable. One of those apartments faces Central Park and the other apartment faces away from Central Park. Everything else about them is identical. You know, the one facing Central Park is going to be worth more because it's got a view. And so the value of that view is essentially the difference between the price of those two apartments. So that's just a way, an example of like eking out a value. Like, does that view cost you anything when you walk out to look at it? Not necessarily. But there's that in that case, you can kind of use the market value of the apartments to value the park or the view of the park. So I use that kind of an approach. I use something called the travel cost model, pretty common economic tool to determine the value. So economic impact, how much surfers spend when they come to a place, economic value, the non-market value of that resource to society and to the surfers.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And, you know, as you said, you've chosen, at least in your dissertation, to look at trestles. And I want to dig into that with you as well, because, sure. You know, I've surfed trestles and, you know, you're kind of just up the road from it. But and it is a world-class spot. It's very well known. And as you said, it was kind of under threat. I think it still continues to be under threat with some of these different projects.
Yeah, in other ways, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, but, you know, I'm just curious, as you were talking about this in your research, surfonomics and some of this, how do you weave these two together with some of your activism as well with Surfrider?
Yeah. And, you know, so, you know, a couple more things, you know, I picked trestles cause it was you know, under threat. It's a super popular surf spot, iconic. So there's a bunch of good reasons to pick it. The other thing that's interesting I was collecting data on surfers, I can get, you know, part of the methodological part of my dissertation was really focused on survey methodology, because that can really influence your outcomes. And Trestles also has kind of like some pretty clear entrances and exits. So it's really convenient for surveying surfers. So I surveyed about 1,300 surfers down at the beach over you know, the course of a year, and in certain surf spots where people are kind of streaming in and out down every block or downstairs, you know, a lot of surf spots have multiple ways to get to them. Trestles is kind of contained, so that was one of the reasons. The other was that the state parks, it's a state park, they kept really good data on attendance. So they counted and estimated the surfer attendance every day. And it's pretty crazy. This was, you know, what was it, over a decade ago, 330,000 surfers a year visit Trestles. So on average, a little over 1,000 a day. Wow. You know, this is cottons, uppers, lowers, middles, all the way down to church. So it was a pretty big stretch. Right. It was multiple waves in one stretch.
Right. So the whole Trestles and the broader Trestles area.
Yeah.
That's, but a lot of people.
Huge number of people. I mean, it's notoriously crowded, and
right.
I had that data too, which is really important, because any estimate of value multiplied by the number of visitors is how you get the total annual value.
So you'd say, sorry, not to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
So you'd say that was probably the main reason, you know, one of the driving forces behind choosing Trestles, and also I assume, you know, proximity to where you live and school too.
Yeah, that's right. Close to the Surfrider office, which is in San Clemente. Crowded, iconic, good data, good sampling. You know, so when you're surveying kind of like how you pick your experiment, those were all the factors. And then it was under threat, which kind of gets to your original question. So I was like, oh, I can calculate these values. And then I can actually share those as like we did in Puerto Rico, with the decision makers to influence the decision. So, you know, the city of San Clemente, you know, for a bunch of different reasons, was pro toll road. We were anti toll road, but I didn't change their minds, but, you know, I showed them that 83% of the visitors that came to Trestles were from out of town, and they contributed $8 to $13 million a year to the economy of the town, which is significant. And so, you know, you degrade the waves, they're going to leave. Another interesting side note, and it's not super surprising, but it's interesting. It gets to one of your other questions about wave quality. They were leaving. I asked these surfers where they were coming from. And, you know, they were coming from Ocean Beach at the border of, you know, southern San Diego to Santa Barbara to Riverside. So some of them were traveling 100 miles.
Right.
A lot of them were leaving surf towns. So they were leaving Oceanside. They were leaving Newport Beach. They were leaving Huntington Beach. So they were leaving good waves right down the street to drive a half hour to come to Trestles. And the only reason they're doing that is because the wave quality is better.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, when I lived in Newport Beach, you know, I consistently went, you know, you'd go check Newport and then you're like, oh, let's just go to Trestles. And I mean, you knew it'd be crowded, but you're right. Like, there's just, it's just a better wave. And so, yeah, it's, you know, it's fascinating how you're able to sort of weave this together with Surfrider and trestles and, you know, you having this empirical data to say, you know, hey, this toll road could have a tangible impact on the wave quality. And if the wave quality, you know, becomes, let's say, substandard, then you're going to lose a wide range of tourists who are contributing, you know, an X amount of dollars a year to the local economy. And so I guess, you know, sort of in sum, that is Surfonomics.
That's right. And so that was, you know, I did sort of three things. I showed them the demographics of the surfers because you just need that data to put into the models. So I was like, hey, the people who are coming to San Clemente are, you know, and this is, you know, was a kind of a subplot of the whole thing, wealthy, well-educated, fully employed. In other words, they reflect the communities they live in, which is not that surprising. Southern California is not cheap. So if you live in Newport Beach or San Clemente or San Diego, North County, San Diego, to live in those places, you have to be, a pretty like sort of well-to-do person who's working and has a job. And so I dispelled the stereotype. These are a bunch of like vagrants showing up. These are people who look like everybody else in your town. Two, they're spending a lot of money in your town when they come. And if the wave goes, you know, if the quality degrades, they're going to stay home. Because if the wave's not any better in Newport, why drive?
Exactly. Yeah.
And then third, you know, it has this non-market value, you know, which I estimated to be about $80, and that changes with inflation. But, you know, there's like this almost $30 million value of sort of like this. This is what the value of the waves to the surfers, this non-market value, willingness to pay. So that's more of an expression of what the value is to the surfing community, a little bit more abstract, but, you know, across those three things. And it really did, you know, I wrote a memo to the Coastal Commission who ultimately denied that project, and they used that information in their sort of arguments. So it played a small role in a complex campaign.
Yeah. You know, you know, the non-tangibles, I guess, I think is the way you put it. You know, I'm thinking, you know, you could, if you live in Newport Beach, you could ride your bike to the beach. Whereas if you want to go to Trestles instead, you're going to pay for gas. Like you said, you're going to stop, maybe scoop up a burrito. Like you're going to, I'm just thinking that's what the wave is worth. I'm going to spend this amount of money to go surf, you know, this wave. So, you know, thinking, you know, you did that, you know, let's say a decade or so ago. And as you're talking, I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, you know, let's say you were to do this dissertation or this research starting in 2023, or, you know, you start your dissertation research, let's say January of 2024, you know, where would you choose a different place? Do you consider it, would you do Trestles again? Do you still think it's that relevant of a place? Is there another place in California or maybe somewhere else globally?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question because I think that like understanding these values and, you know, like Save the Waves, for example, has done a lot of Surfonomics reports in other parts of the world, which is awesome. It's become sort of foundational in their World Surfing Reserve project, which is really neat to see. And so, you know, I think it's still relevant at Trestles. I was trying to find this, you know, it was the first time anyone had come up with a non-market valuation for surfing. But it's a super high quality wave, you know? So if I could do it again, one thing I might try to do is, you know, if I had more time and resources, I'd look at like three or four different waves, and have like, you know, a Lowers or a Trestles at the top, and maybe some of these kind of like mid-tier waves and maybe some lower end waves. You could get the full spectrum. You know, that would be one kind of way to advance the research. I mean, the other thing to do would be to, you know, go to another area of world-class waves and look at those too. But then again, you're getting the high value. You know, you think about a place like Pipeline, and we all know it's super spectacular, but most of us can't ride it. You know, and
We go to many of us go to watch.
Well, so. And I was going to say that would actually be kind of the interesting thing there.
Right.
There was some research done by my advisor on surfing in Huntington Beach. And one of their implications was that actually one of the reasons people go to Huntington Beach actually is a tourism is to watch surfers. So that's interesting too. That has value.
Yeah. And so, setting up, posting up there on the pier and just watching. Yeah.
So a lot of non-surfers want to watch surfers, and a lot of us surfers who are mere mortals would love to go up and watch guys surf pipeline, even though we can't go out in the water, but it's the same thing, right? If you spent the day and drove up to the North Shore from Honolulu, for example, you'd probably get lunch, get some gas. And so surf tourism observation kind of has the same impact. So those are some ways maybe, you know, you could expand on or look at what I did sort of differently.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, I mean, if you want to go internationally, you could, you know, look at something we'll talk about later as Chopu or, you know, with my research, look at places like Popoyo in Nicaragua, the sort of economic valuation of that area because of the draw to the wave. And so, you kind of mentioned it and, you know, you mentioned Save the Waves, of course, which is another incredible organization. Yeah. What are some other places around the world kind of specifically has, let's say, I know we mentioned NUSA, but are there any other places around the world where this sort of your surfonomics framework is being applied to, you know, anywhere, any of these, any breaks around the world?
Yeah, I, you know,
I don't know if that made sense.
Yeah, no. Yeah. You know, sort of where's surfonomics gone over the last decade? And, you know, one thing that was really interesting is when I was doing this, when I decided, okay, I'm going to look at surfonomics, I'm going to start looking at surfing. So I started doing, again, you do your literature review, and I was, you know, scanning Google Scholar and anything I could find to try to find any existing literature on surfing. And there wasn't much at all. In fact, Surfrider had done something before my time where they valued a lost wave in LA, and they kind of used a day at Disneyland, which I thought was pretty funny. That was like the closest substitute. But I found a guy named Neil Lazaro, who was an Australian who's actually doing similar research over in Australia at the same time I was. And we were like, you know, we kind of found each other and became pals and sort of, you know, exchanged information and resources. And so that was good, but we were the only two at the time. And that we were aware of. And since then, I think, you know, the use of surfonomics has really exploded. There's a guy named Jason Scorse up at in Santa Cruz. I think he's at Monterey Institute of International Studies, MIS. He's an economist, and he's been sort of looking at the impact of surfing on home values in Santa Cruz. You know, which is kind of interesting. I didn't really think of that, but of course, being in proximity to surf spots can actually increase home value. So he was using that technique. Save the Waves has looked at surfonomics at Ensenada, Chile at Punta de Lobos, down in Brazil. So I bumped into some guys when we were at the Global Wave Conference that are doing research in Portugal. So it really seems to have blown up. And, you know, interestingly enough, something that's happened to me is subsequent to doing that research, I end up getting hired as the CEO at Surfrider. And so that job's been pretty all consuming. And so I have kind of stepped away from research. So I'm not as in touch with it as I used to be. Now I'm trying to usually raise some funds to fund the research instead of actually doing it. So I've lost touch a little bit with what's happening most recently. That said, right now we're trying to raise a little bit of money to actually redo the original surfonomics study in Puerto Rico that was published in 2001 to kind of do because that town has really transformed since then. It's pretty underground, quiet surf town, not a lot of tourism. It's now much more popular place, much more sustainable, environmentally responsibly managed, including the Marine Reserve we set up. So I kind of want to do a before and after comparison. So I'm trying to work with a grad student to kind of replicate that study and see what's changed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting how you say, like, your role now with the Surf Rider Foundation is, you know, you're doing less academic research, but I would say your doctoral research and having that doctorate is really, you know, in my view, legitimizes you as the rightful CEO for an organization like the Surf Rider Foundation. I mean, your work and your passion as an activist is, I mean, it's just, in my view, you know, you're the perfect fit. And, you know, I just kind of remember even first meeting you at one of the earlier Global Wave conferences and thinking, like, you know, it's pretty awesome to have somebody with this incredible organization that has a doctorate, you know, like, yeah. It helped legitimize what I was doing. I'm like, okay, like, I can be a surfer and a scholar, and individuals like you help, you know, show the rest of us that, you know, we can have legitimate careers loving surfing, but also having a very tangible positive impact on the environment. So I think it's a great fit. And, you know, but I do want to dig into some of your research a little more. I want to give you a quote from your dissertation and, you know, sort of pick your brain on it. And I do think, as I was reading your dissertation, what you're doing at the Surf Rider Foundation, it completely overlaps.
Yeah, and totally agree.
You know, you say surfing areas are sensitive to environmental changes resulting from natural geomorphologic changes and human interruption of natural coastal systems. And so, I mean, that's right at the heart of what you guys do with the Surf Rider Foundation.
Yeah,
at least in my view. And so, you know, as a scholar and the CEO of the Surf Rider Foundation, what role do you think we, you know, myself and other surfers could and should play as stewards of these coastal ecosystems?
Yeah, it's like, a great.
How can we join forces? Let's say.
Yeah. So it's interesting too, because there are also a bunch of academics, including like Ed Atkins, who I think you've interviewed. And others who really focused on this science of, you know, sort of like the physics and science of describing wave breaking academically, like sort of quantitatively, which has also been a hugely valuable thing, because surfing and waves in many ways can be really difficult to measure and subjective. But, you know, I think one of the things that, you know, I've always felt is, if you look at any coastline, the Nicaraguan coastline, the California coastline, New Zealand coastline, the Australian coastline, the world's coastlines, the number of waves that are great for surfing relative to the total number of waves out there is actually quite small. And so all these things need to come together just right to make a great surf spot. You need the right sort of angle of wave breaking. You need the right tides, you need the right wind, all these things need to come together. And it's pretty rare to get a good surf spot relative to all the other waves that are breaking that aren't that surfable. And it's really rare to get these ones that are just the gems that we all know. And we also know they're really sensitive to change. A foot of tide change can affect a wave. You know, if the sand shifts, it can affect a wave. There's a wave, Barra de la Cruz, down in mainland Mexico that famously, like, disappeared. You know, they had a contest there. Everyone wanted to show up. It famously disappeared because the sand washed out. The point break went away. It's back now. But, the wind. So, you know, subtle shifts in the environment can change the wave quality. And, you know, that was the point I wanted to make at Trestles. Hey, you know, is the wave going to disappear if you build this toll road? Probably not, but the water quality is going to degrade from the freeway. The cobble and sediment that come down the watershed that make that wave so magical are going to be cut off. So it's going to degrade over time. And if the quality of that wave goes from, say, a 10 out of a 10 to a 7 out of 10, maybe people are going to stay home. They'll surf Oceanside or Newport. And so, you know, I think that idea that these are really sensitive, special, unique places, like an endangered species, speaks to the reason we should really work hard to protect them and the natural systems that create them, right? That wave is a confluence of the watershed, the offshore health, all these things coming together. So you really got to protect the whole ecosystem, which is what Save the Waves is doing. And, so if you're a passionate surfer or you just care about these places, there's waves I will probably never surf or visit, but I still want them to be there. I think you should be invested in protecting the ecosystem the surf ecosystem, as Save the Waves call it, the water quality, and also sort of the community in those places. Because at the end of the day, it's the community that's the stewards. We want important laws and policies to protect places, but those laws and policies never do it by themselves. It requires a community of people who care to make sure those laws are enforced and applied. So all of us, I think, have a stake in, getting involved in our local communities, and all of us have a stake in kind of, protecting these places. And that can be done by advancing academics. That can be done by being a local activist. That can be done by supporting causes that you care about. There's a lot of ways, that we all participate. I just think everybody should sort of have an oar in the water and be trying to, contribute in some ways, given how much we all get from these spots.
Absolutely. And I have one more question from your research, and then I want to get into more specifically about the Surfrider Foundation and, kind of move in that direction. Cause I think it's important for the listeners to get a deeper understanding of what it is, what you all do. And more importantly, you just kind of alluded to, like, how can we be involved in this? As you said, there's plenty of waves out in the world that you and I probably won't surf, but we do want them to exist, and we do want them to be accessible for, those that can surf it. And so, my question comes from chapter 4, actually. And I think the chapter was mitigating the adverse impacts of shoreline armoring on California beaches. And so I guess first off, what do you mean by armoring, and why is that a concern? And the other thing is how, why would somebody want to armor the beach, so to speak? And, what's the impacts of have climate change had on a lot of the stuff that we're talking about?
Yeah. So, beaches are one of the most dynamic landscapes on the planet. Sand can move 6 vertical feet in a couple hours with the right swell and current. So they're super, super dynamic. And, over geologic time, they've moved miles in and out, up and down the coasts in different places. And so we as humans have made the mistake, mostly because we love these places so much, of building too close to this super dynamic landscape. And then it changes, and then it threatens our infrastructure. So, you build your house too close to the bluff in Pacifica or in San Diego, and the coasts start to, erode, which is what they do, and your house is threatened, or we knock down the dunes because we want a whitewater view. And then the coastlines, the water starts to encroach your house. And so that coastal erosion problem, which isn't a problem until humans get in the way, coastal erosion is actually what made our coastlines to begin with, the beautiful places we love and most of our surf spots. Every point break's a function of coastal erosion. And, but then our infrastructure, our roads, our homes, get threatened by coastal erosion. So there's basically 3 things you can do in response to coastal erosion. One is armor the coast. So you build a seawall. That could be a revetment, riprap rocks. It could be a vertical wall. Just, hey, we're going to force the erosion to stop. 2, you can add sand to the beach nourishment. Or 3, you can move back. Easy to say, hard to do. We tend not to do that, although we have a couple good examples. But so if you armor the coastline, the ocean still wants to encroach the coast. And so, if you had like a nice wide beach and the ocean's encroaching, that beach is getting narrower and narrower in a natural system. it tends to erode the dune or the bluff, and that contributes sand to the beach, and the beach, the whole beach kind of moves inland but stays its equal width. If you fix the back of the beach and the water keeps encroaching, it squeezes the beach out, so you lose the beach. And then before you know it, at high tide, the water's rebounding off the seawall, causing more coastal erosion. It actually accelerates the problem and can impact the surf, and you lose the recreational access to the beach. So unfortunately, that's been sort of the typical approach to a lot of coastal erosion. About 10% of California coastlines armored, and more is being done as we see coastal erosion occur. And coastal erosion, generally is happening because we're losing sediment supply to the coast. So sand and sediment usually comes down rivers, and we've paved our watersheds, and our creeks are now storm drains. You know, think of Terminator or Grease. It used to be a sandy river down to the beach. So we're cut off the sediment supply, and sea levels are rising, both over geologic time and ice ages. Sea level rise is a natural phenomenon, and as we know, greatly accelerated by climate change. So on average, it depends on the geologic circumstances, but on average, sea level's risen about 8 inches in the last 100 years. And that's enough to cause a fair number of challenges, like 86% of the California coastline's eroding. Well, we're gonna see 1 to 3 feet, in the next 50 years. So a doubling, tripling of sea level rise is happening, and that's gonna accelerate all these problems. And so again, if the knee-jerk reaction is to armor the beach, they just did this at San Onofre, kind of a really famous longboard surf spot, classic spot just south of Trestles. And we're seeing the impacts of that seawall affecting the beach and the surf already. And so that was what I was concerned about. And so one sort of economic approach to that is, hey, if you're the homeowner, you get to build a seawall because your house is going to fall in the ocean. Great for you. At the cost of the public beach, which is going to disappear. So should you, homeowner, have to pay for that lost recreational access to the beach over time, and ecological impacts too, right? So that beach could be a sea turtle nesting beach. It could be important to seabirds. It could be a haul out site for marine mammals. That beach is an ecosystem. It's not just, a pile of sand for us to put our towels on. And so I was in my dissertation, I was like looking at the how to fairly figure out what that mitigation cost for lost ecosystem services and beach access is, under this theory that, hey, if the private parties are going to benefit and the public is going to lose, they should be responsible for compensating for that lost opportunity. And both that would create a pool of money to do mitigation, and also maybe disincentivize building seawalls in the first place. If it got really, really expensive, the formula would change.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. And I, Dan Reinemann and I talked about that in our episode. And he and I, being originally from like the Virginia Beach, Outer Banks area myself, we were talking about that area. You have all these people, and to your point, people want to be close to the ocean. When you build a house as the case with the Outer Banks, shifting sands, when the sand does what it does and has been doing, as you said, over, geological time, the house tends to, fall victim to the ocean. And so you saw that and see that, say, in the Outer Banks as well. But yeah, I find what you're talking about interesting, because if someone wants to put up a seawall, the repercussions of that, how responsible should that individual be? I mean, that's a pretty serious question, I want to segue now into Surfrider, because as I said already, I mean, your work with your research, your dissertation, all that is literally it completely overlaps with, it seems to me, what you're doing now. I mean, it's the it's spot on. So, you know, but as far as Surfrider, you know, Surfrider is, you know, at least the way I understand it, is the world's largest grassroots coastal and ocean conservation organization dedicated to the protection and enjoyment of the world's oceans, waves, and beaches. So my question for you as the CEO is, what are some of your most proud moments, you know, as the CEO of Surfrider Foundation, both domestically in the U.S. and internationally, maybe collaborating with other chapters?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, we it's interesting. We keep track of like what we call a coastal victory, which means that like we you know, it's one of our impact metrics. And the definition of a coastal victory is, you know, an official decision made in benefit of the coast. So this means that, you know, a small town banned single-use plastic bags all the way up to, you know, the federal government, you know, making a decision not to drill for oil off our coastlines. And so we've had, you know, since we started counting in 2006, you know, almost 900 coastal victories. So lots of little wins happening all the time across our network. So tons of impact. And this is really at the end of the day, and this is why I'm such a firm believer in Surfrider's model. This is mostly coastal community members deciding to take action in their towns to do things that are going to protect our oceans and coasts, which is cool to see. And then we try to scale that up to the state and the federal level. So different, you know, different sort of levels. But some of the wins that I'm most proud of is, you know, I'm really proud of stopping that toll road at Trestles. When that campaign started over 15 years ago, the road was already on the maps. The governor at the time was Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he was a great guy, but he was pro toll road. He wanted this road to go in. A lot of people told us it was unwinnable. The road was going to be built, so we're wasting our time. And one of my colleagues at the time, a great guy named Matt McLean, who ran our marketing department, he had this kind of moment in our office where he was like, we're in San Clemente, we're the Surfrider Foundation, and we're not going to fight this road that's going to destroy a world-class surf spot because we don't think we can win. If that's the case, we should fold up shop and go home. And he was right. So we took that on. We were told we couldn't win, and we won. We also set records for the most people to ever go to a state parks commission meeting, a coastal commission meeting, and a commerce hearing. Thousands and thousands of people showed up. I call it the Woodstock of surfing conservation. There were bands, people in costumes. It was like celebratory. And so part of that win was fighting against the odds and protecting this really special place, including a state park, the fifth most state popular state park in California. But it was also because it was a people's movement. It was that grassroots movement that really saved it, you know, against the political odds. So that's one. And we talked about this marine reserve in Puerto Rico. Really proud of that. I was one of the first marine reserves to kind of focus on coastal recreation, and really shape the trajectory of that small town in a positive way. And then sort of more recently, you know, the Trump administration, you know, almost 4 years ago, I guess even longer when they announced it, when he got elected, he proposed opening all coasts of the United States to offshore drilling, which was, you know, one of those threats that I didn't think we still were going to have to face. And, you know, we rallied long and hard to oppose that. And again, we started in local communities and used economics. You know, if you're a small town in North Carolina, you're a restaurant owner or a hotel owner, you have very little to gain from drilling off your coasts and everything to lose. Because if there's an oil spill, no one's going to come to your beach and your restaurant, your hotel is going to go out of business. So we were able to kind of use local surfonomics or beach economics to persuade folks that this drilling was to the benefit of these international oil companies and not to local economies. And as a result of that, we got Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina to oppose offshore drilling, even though they were right-leaning states that tended to be pro oil and gas generally. And so we're really proud of the fact that, again, it was a We were using economics, we were using grassroots organizing, and frankly, some common sense and a lot of hustling around to ultimately, you know, convince coastal communities and then states and then ultimately the federal government that that offshore drilling wasn't the answer. So those are some of the wins that I'm really proud of. And all of them are, you know, really focused around people power, you know, and local engagement. We, you know, back to sort of the dissertation, and we want to make sure that we're always being science-based in our advocacy. So having that solid science background, factual background for anything we advocate for, you know, and sometimes the economics really makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's incredible, you know, and just, you know, like you said, you just mentioned, you know, Florida, what was it? Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, the South, basically, that is, you know, at least in more recent times has historically been more conservative and more apt to get on board to some of these, you know, drillings and all of that. And so, you know, I guess what I gathered from that as you were talking was, one, again, just to reiterate that surfers aren't just aloof and want to just go catch waves. And, you know, these campaigns really transcend, let's say, certain political boundaries and you know, both, you know, that spectrum of, you know, political leanings. People, you know, no matter where people fall on that spectrum, a lot of times, like, we value the ocean, we value conservation, we want that, you know, something that, you know, Dan Reinemann said in our interview, kind of paraphrasing, but it was like, the waves that I get to surf or my dad gets to surf, you know, I want my grandkids to surf those. And that's really, you know, it feels to me that seems to be at the heart, you know, say of Surf Rider Foundation. And like, really, you guys are champions for preserving these, our world's oceans and waves for future generations. And, so I guess, you know, kind of to, I've sort of broken this into two questions, but I want to start with, what are some of your current campaigns that you guys have going on domestically here in the U.S.?
Yeah, so there are sort of two, maybe three big buckets. You know, we're still fighting the plague of plastic pollution in our oceans, you know, too much plastic ending up in our seas for a bunch of different reasons, but single-use plastics, which is what we're finding on beaches still, every beach cleanup, are the lowest hanging fruit. We just need to get rid of those. So we're kind of working state by state to try to, you know, community by community, state by state to pass laws to regulate single-use plastics. You know, we banned foam in Delaware this year, for example. So we're chipping away. We passed laws in Oregon and Washington to do the same. And the sort of most, the interesting, the most important plastic pollution laws that are coming down the pike now, California passed a bill like this, as did Maine, is called extended producer responsibility, which is buzzwordy, but what it means is extending the responsibility of the plastic pollution to the producer. So, you know, the same way you can kind of bring your iPhone in to get it recycled, we want the producers of the plastic to be responsible for the end life of the plastic. And that, we think that'll be game changing. Instead of us trying to like recycle or beach clean up our way out of it, we want the people making the stuff to be responsible for it. So a lot of work on plastic pollution laws. The second is we're launching a program called the Climate Action Program, looking at nature-based solutions to these sea level rise and coastal erosion problems. So instead of seawalls, like we talked about, let's replant dunes, let's replant mangroves, let's restore wetlands. These are all natural buffers to sea level rise. They provide habitat. They suck in a lot of carbon. Blue carbon's become a new sort of thing. We realize that these coastal ecosystems can be really good job of sequestering the carbon. It could solve 20% of the sort of climate change problem. So really working hard to find ways to adapt to sea level rise and create nature-based solutions. And last is we've got a federal bill called the Beach Act that we helped write in 2000. It funds national water quality monitoring. And so, you know, we want to make sure that we all know if it's safe to surf, swim, or play before we go to the ocean. So every year we're fighting to get this thing funded, you know, we usually get about $10 million. We want to get it up to 15 and ultimately 30 million, which is nothing compared to the like multi-billion dollar beach tourism economy. And so, you know, we think spending some money to make sure the water's clean is worth doing. So those are some of the things that we're currently focused on.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I want to, you know, now I have an international question, and I know, you know, where this is going because you and I have talked about this, but, yep. You know, with the Olympics coming up and surfing taking place, unless something radically changes, taking place in Chopu, you know, so I have a bit of an international question. How does Surfrider work with local government agencies to provide preventative measures? And, you know, sort of leaning into the Chopu scenario, you know, what is going on there for our listeners who might not be aware? And, you know, is there a local chapter of Surfrider who's able to get involved? Or, you know, what is Surfrider doing as a way to voice their opinions with regard to this, you know, building this sort of structure over the reef?
Yeah, judging tower. So Surfrider has international affiliates in Europe, which is based in France, which is relevant for this, but also, you know, Australia, Canada, Senegal, Morocco, Japan. And so, you know, we tend to want to work with locals and local communities because they know what's best. And we try not to weigh in on issues when we're not connected to the local community because it's hard to know what's going on. Tahiti is a French territory. So it's sort of under the purview of Surfrider Europe, which is French. The French are leading the 2024 Olympics. They just happen to be having, you know, everything's taking place in France and Paris and, you know, that area, except for surfing, which is taking place in this, you know, former French colony territory now. And so this is really a Surfrider Europe issue and we're supporting them, but it's also a global issue, right? Because it's the Olympics. And the controversy is, you know, this wave at Chopu is a reef pass. So it's this incredible coral reef that makes this wave. You know, it's one of the most iconic, terrifying, magical, amazing waves on the planet. You know, a really small village is sort of adjacent to this spot. And, you know, the World Surf League, the WSL, has been holding championship contests there for the last 20 years. And has an older, you know, structure like a tower built on the reef so that the judges can, you know, watch the waves. And this is not uncommon at reef. There's one in Tavarua and Fiji too, at these reef passes because they're pretty far offshore. You know, it's the fringing reef off the island. So it's hard to see from the beach. The controversy is that the Paris, you know, the French Olympic Committee wanted to build a giant aluminum tower at a new location on the reef because they said the existing tower that gets put up and taken down for every contest is inadequate. The local surfing community, including, you know, some of these internationally recognized local Tahitian surfers who are incredibly talented, have come out in strong opposition to this new tower, saying it's overbuilt, it's going to have unnecessary impacts on the reef. You know, the Olympics has a long history of overbuilding for their Olympics for all kinds of sports, arenas that don't get used again and things like that. And so, you know, there's fear that this is going to harm the reefs. The local community has been pretty vocal about it. They've gotten a fair amount of attention in the surfing community. You know, we've been working with the folks at in Surfrider Europe to kind of understand this, try to understand the impacts. And, you know, it kind of is a classic case of it. Like a lot of these issues is someone wants to build something that, you know, the local community is opposed to. Usually what you want to do is try to understand the science and information behind that. It's been very difficult to get that information. You know, so they say the old tower isn't up to par, but they haven't really given any specific reasons to why, you know, and, you know, they say they have certain needs, but they haven't really been able to articulate those. So the rationale for a bigger tower that's going to impact the reefs, in my opinion, has been sort of poorly substantiated. I also think, you know, these local surfers and these communities have been stewards of these reefs for generations. It's their spot. The Olympics is going to come and go in a matter of days and weeks, and they're going to be left with this place that they've been stewarding. So I think more deference should be given to the local community. And they seem to, you know, there seems to be some progress made on that, but not enough. You know, it'd be a shame, in my opinion, to have the surfing in the Olympics be marred by this local controversy when it's pretty clear that I feel like if they really did it, made a genuine effort to work with the local community, they could find a solution that kind of meets the minimum needs of the Olympics and also is satisfactory to the locals. I mean, they've been hosting contests there forever, so it's not like they're anti-contest. I think they just have a genuine concern about the impacts. You know, the Paris Olympics is going to come and go, and these people are going to rely on those reefs for their livelihoods and their well-being forever. So Surfrider US, in conjunction with Surfrider Europe, kind of weighed in on this on Friday. Also last week, you know, one of the incidents that really put this thing on the sort of global map was the local surfers warned that the site they were going to try to build it was too shallow and that they were going to end up like running on ground on the reef if they tried to build there. The organizers seem to have ignored that. And then last week, sure enough, they brought a barge out without anything on it and ran aground on the reef. Kind of, in my opinion, you know, proving the locals were correct and harming the credibility of the organizers. So that's kind of where things stand right now. And my hope is that the organizers will listen and get more involved with the local community to try to find a solution that everyone can live with.
Yeah. You know, it's always troubling when these outside entities, you know, like you say, this Olympic Committee and those involved just sort of overstep and ignore the local insight of people who have been, you know, living in these environments for, like you say, generations. And so, yeah, hopefully, you know, things will pan out. Of course, you know, we're recording this podcast in December. It'll be, you know, it'll be coming out in the spring. And hopefully some sort of agreement will be met by that time at the, you know, when the Olympics start. So hopefully, you know, things will pan out and the local community will be at least heard or at least, you know, perhaps even a beneficiary of this event more so than they seem to be now. Chad, you know, this is, you know, I think you and I could sit and chat all day long about this stuff. So, but I, you know, I'm going to have to go ahead and give you the last word. And usually I just kind of, you know, it's sort of open-ended, but I have a very sort of specific one for you because of, you know, the fact that you are the CEO of the Surfrider Foundation. You have, you know, both a domestic and international reach. And, you know, I really, really want individuals to plug in and come alongside and volunteer and be part of this, you know, awesome organization. And so I am going to give you the last word, but I want you to tell us, myself included, but the listeners as well, how can we be part of this organization, whether, you know, say we live in California or Florida, somewhere else in the U.S., or we live abroad? How do we get involved? And with that, you go ahead and get the last word.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, so two things. Join the Surfrider Foundation. You know, an annual membership's $5 minimum. There's power in numbers. So the more members we have, the more influence we can have to protect our ocean waves and beaches. So I encourage everyone to just sign up as a member. And then two is get active locally. You know, we've got chapters all over the country, all over the world, with our affiliates. So, you know, roll up your sleeves and get involved in your local community. And if Surfrider's not there, there's probably somebody else working to protect your coasts and your oceans. So get involved with them. If there's anything I've learned in the last 25 years, it's that people who care really do, can and do make a huge difference. So I encourage everybody to find a way to get involved in protecting these places that give us so much and we love so much.
This episode concludes season 2 of the Surfing Historian podcast. I want to take a moment to thank our audio engineer, Taylor Ramon, as well as our sponsors, our guests, and of course, all of our loyal listeners from around the world. Thanks for an incredible season. I'm your host, Dr. Jason Old, and until next time, stay stoked. We also want to take a moment to thank Sovereign Republic again for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check them out at sovereignrepublic.com, and while you're there, use promo code STAYSTOKED for 15% off your purchase. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Surfing Historian. If you're stoked on these conversations, be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. And don't forget to check out our killer merch at surfinghistorian.com. Proceeds go to help keep this amazing podcast going strong. Until next time, stay stoked.